I don't know about you guys, but I was a little bit jealous of the hair of that baby in that video, right? hey, I did want to just bring this up. So if you would like more information about Sanctity of Human Life Sunday and what that means, we have some pamphlets at Beginning Point. And I actually am going to do a dedicated sermon towards that later on in this year. But we were already kind of in a series, but we did want to just remind you guys that we are for life because God is for life. Well, after last week's message, I'm surprised so many of you actually returned because we started this series called Unfulfilled, The Search for Meaning. And this is a series through the book of Ecclesiastes. And if you were here last week, we went through Ecclesiastes 1, and you know that message was a bit of a downer. I had someone come up to me after the service and they said, you know, I don't drink, but after that message, I think I need a beer. If you've never read through Ecclesiastes before, it hits you like a ton of bricks because at first, King Solomon, who we presume to be the author, the way he talks about life can just be a bit jarring and raw. Like if you Google inspirational verses from the Bible, you're probably not going to get a lot of results from Ecclesiastes. And so if you were here last week, you got a little taste of that. But to be honest, there's a lot more of that coming in this book. So last week we looked at Solomon's favorite word as he describes this thing called life. And over we read that Solomon uses this word meaningless, or some translations say vanity, to describe his experiences with life. He'll say, everything's meaningless. All is vanity. It's like chasing after the wind. And those translations are pretty good. They capture the idea of what Solomon is saying. But the Old Testament was primarily written in the Hebrew language, and the Hebrew word that we translate as meaningless or vanity is this word hevel. And that word more literally means vapor or Solomon's going to use it 38 times throughout this book of Ecclesiastes. And with this word picture, it's as if Solomon is saying, you know, every time I think about life, and every time I think I've got it figured out, it's a lot like dealing with smoke or vapor. You see it, and when it's thick enough, it looks like it can even be solid, something like you can grab onto, but if you try to hold onto it, it just goes right through your fingers. And he's saying, life is like this. Every time I think I've got it figured out, every time I've got this plan for how I'm going to get along better in life, how I'm going to succeed, how I'm going to win at life when others have failed, every time it's just hevel. It's an enigma. It's hard to predict. It's difficult to wrap my mind around, and it's challenging in so many ways. And Solomon talks about this over and over again throughout his book. And so at the end of chapter 1, where we left off last week, Solomon is going to talk about this grand experiment that he's going to undertake in his search for meaning. And we find that in this experiment, Solomon is going to basically pursue all the ways that people try to find meaning and purpose and fulfillment in life. And he's going to see, is there anything to all this? So I want to jump ahead just for a moment and read part of Ecclesiastes 2:9. Solomon says this about his experiment. He says that in all of this, my wisdom stayed with me. Well, what does he mean by that? Well, first I need to backtrack a little bit. In 1 Kings chapter 3, we read of the story about how God appeared to Solomon in a dream, and he said to Solomon, ask for whatever you want of me, and I'm going to give it to you. And here's what Solomon said. Now, Lord, my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, but I'm only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So he says, so give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours? And the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, since you've asked for this and not for long life, for the death of your enemies, but you've asked instead for discernment in administering justice, wise and discerning heart, so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I'll give you what you have not asked for. both wealth and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. So when Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 2 that in all of his experimenting in life, that his wisdom stayed with him, I believe what he's saying is that he never forgot what he was doing. He never got so caught up in the seeking of all the things in this world and all the things that seemed to offer fulfillment that he forgot that his goal was from the very beginning to see if there was really anything to all of it. To see if from day one, he never forgot that this was all just an experiment. He never lost sight that this was intentionally seeking meaning in his indulgences. So he kind of had the best of both worlds here. He's going to act like an addict, but he keeps his wits about him somehow. And you and I, we can't do this, mainly because we don't have the unparalleled wisdom that God gave Solomon. So if you have a Bible or a Bible app, we're going to be in Ecclesiastes 2 today if you want to follow along. We'll also have the references up on the screen. We're just going to kind of camp out in this passage for the most part. So let's read this passage starting in verse 1 as Solomon begins his experiment. And his first attempt at trying to find meaning in life is he's going to pursue pleasure. Verse 1, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be hevel, to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly or foolishness, the opposite of wisdom. But my mind was still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. Solomon says, I'm just going to see if I can live life to the full. All these things that people enjoy doing, I'm going to pursue that with all of my might. So just after Christmas, on December 27th, there was a single winning ticket for the Mega Millions jackpot that was sold in Cottonwood, California, where the prize had reached an estimated $1.22 billion, a single ticket. You ever daydream what it would be like to win one of those lottery prizes? You know, it seems like I only daydream about it when the lottery is at some massive amount, you know, like it's approaching $1 billion. Then I'm like tempted to buy a ticket, you know, but other times it's like, Mega Millions is only at $77 million, you know, so I'm not tempted to buy a ticket then because, you know, as a pastor, $77 million isn't going to really change my lifestyle, right? Well, I'm calling this message, what if I won the lottery? What if I won the lottery? Because Solomon, by far, is the richest man in the world at this time. And he was going to use all of his vast resources to pursue all kinds of pleasure. Like if you could dream it, Solomon could do it. He was that rich. So to go along with the message today, if you want to look under your pews, I have taped a scratch-off lottery ticket under every seat. I'm just kidding. I want to keep my job. Unless I win $1.22 billion, then it doesn't matter. So Solomon is going to use all of this wealth, all his provisions, all his privilege in life, all that he has at his disposal to pursue pleasure, to see if there's anything to all of it. And so as we go through the text in chapter 2, you'll see kind of like seasons of Solomon's life. And I don't know if this is linear. I don't know if he takes one thing and pursues it for a while and then drops it and then pursues another thing, or if this is cyclical, or if he's just doing it all at once. But what we're going to see is that with all of these things, Solomon is going to try to take everything to 100 and to try to get the most out of it to see if it provides him with any lasting meaning. And so you start to see this scene develop in Ecclesiastes 2 where Solomon is like, you know, I just tried the party scene for a while. And I partied hard. I partied in ways that you and I, we can just never even fathom. A little over a year ago, we had a little, our life group over to our house for a little party. And someone from our group, she had just recently become a Christian. And she told her husband she was going to this party at the pastor's house, you know. And he's like, what's a Christian party like anyway? She's like, I don't know, but we're going to find out. And we had a great time, but our little party was nothing like the way that Solomon partied. And when you read about Solomon's lifestyle, what you see is this guy knew how to throw a party, like epic parties. So let me jump back for a second to 1 Kings chapter 4. And I want to just read to you about Solomon's daily provisions. These are daily things that he is going through in his life of partying. In 1 Kings 4:22, it says that Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of the finest flour. Now, we don't measure things in cores equals 5.5 tons. 5.5 tons of the finest flour daily. And 60 cores of meal, that would be 11. Stall-fed cattle. Staddle-fed? Oh, wait. Stall-fed cattle. Try saying that 5 times fast. 20 of pasture-fed cattle. And 100 sheep and goats, as well as deer, gazelles, roebucks, and choice fowl. So we're told that Solomon goes through all of this every single day. Now, obviously, this is not just for Solomon. No, Solomon is inviting tons of people into his palaces. Yes, I said palaces, to have epic parties. Most scholars would suggest that with the amount of food here, he's probably feeding between 15 to 20,000 people every day. I have a feeling that no matter what kind of bash or barbecue you have over Martin Luther King Jr. weekend that we have right now, because I know so many of you are going to barbecue tomorrow, right? No matter what kind of party you throw, even this year, if you would invite Solomon, he'd probably be like, well, isn't this special? This is cute, right? But somewhere along the way, he must have gotten tired of these parties day after day after day. I don't know if he got tired of waking up in the back of a chariot with a big headache, not knowing where he is with this tatted on his arm, no regrets, right? I don't know if that was what was going on. But at some point along the way, Solomon, in his wisdom, realizes this isn't as fulfilling as he hoped it would be. He had some regrets about this. And so you see him move on from one thing to another as we go through the text. Let's pick up in verse 4 of chapter 2. He says, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. So Solomon begins engaging in these amazing projects to see if he can find fulfillment in any of that. So we see that he didn't just build a house for himself. He says, I built houses or palaces for myself. And what we actually know when we look through the record is that Solomon didn't just build a house for himself. He started actually building houses for his wives. Notice I said wives, not wife. If you know anything about Solomon, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but he had quite a few wives. But get this. It took Solomon, more like his servants, Solomon's servants, 7 years to build the temple in Jerusalem for God. And this temple, it was amazing, and it was ornate, and it was considered one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world. 7 years to finish that. But do you know how long it took for him, how long he spent building his first house, his first palace? 14 years. 14 years. They say if you really want to test your marriage, you should build a house together or have one built. Well, Sarah and I must have a really strong marriage because we've built 2 houses or had 2 houses built. We've been through that process twice, and she's not killed me yet. And then this building expansion project that we're doing here at the church, this is the 4th major church project that I've been a part of in my nearly 25 years of full-time ministry. And there's something about going through that long process of building, from going from plans on paper and then seeing it all come together, and then that amazing feeling of moving in. But Solomon would probably look at all of our house plans and church building plans and the end result of them and just kind of scoff. And go, child's play. I mean, not only did I build these huge palaces, but, you know, your little raised bed gardens in your backyard, those are cute. Or that little family farm that you run, it's nice. But I built forests. I put up gardens that you couldn't even walk through in an entire day. And I've got what you all might label as national parks in my backyard. In fact, to this day, in order to water all of the things that Solomon had planted, you can still go and see all of these pools that Solomon built on the southwest side of Jerusalem that were dug in the ground as reservoirs to water all of these plants and vineyards that he built. So basically, Solomon is trying to build all of this stuff that will stand the test of time. The years later, people will admire and say, Solomon did that. He's trying to build a legacy for himself. But somewhere down the line, he decides, okay, I've built enough. Now it's time to enjoy the work of my hands, or better yet, the work of my servant's hands. And so he's going to enter into a season of just living large and enjoying kind of retirement. Look at the next few verses, starting in verse 7. He says, I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. So Solomon moves on from the party scene and from massing building projects, and now he's just going to kind of live a life of ease. He's just going to get slaves to do all the work for him. But get this, his slaves have their own slaves. Like, you get the idea that Solomon does nothing for himself. He doesn't have to lift a finger. And some of you with teenagers in your home, you're like, that sounds like the life, right? Like, I want someone to come around and just walk behind my teenager and pick up all of the junk that just falls off of them and onto my floor every single day. Solomon is just enjoying his wealth, though. He's got cattle. He's got horses. Some of you remember that old cartoon DuckTales where Scrooge McDuck is diving into a pool of gold? Like, that's Solomon. He's just amassing gold and silver and everything. And Solomon, he doesn't just stream music from a band that he likes. Solomon buys the band, and he has his own personal concerts. Like, Solomon is the ultimate Swiftie. Taylor Swift is just coming to his house for personal concerts and living in one of his palaces. And not only that, but Solomon is enjoying the company of women. And there were lots of them. Solomon, get this, had 700 wives. 700. And he had 300 concubines, which is like the nice Bible word for girlfriends on the side. 1,000 women. Now, some of these women were, these wives were parts of deals with other foreign leaders, like, we'll sign this peace treaty if you'll marry one of my daughters. But I want you to think about this. Solomon did not lack for anything. Like, any fantasy a man might have, anytime Solomon wanted a woman to do something for him, he just had to think about it and then call for it, and it happened. He spent his life engaging in completely uninhibited sexuality. And after all of that, Solomon finds that, just like the party scene, just like the enormous building projects, just like the retirement scene, he can never really scratch that itch. It's not leading to fulfillment. So let's go on, verses 9 through 11. He says, I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I'll date myself here with this reference. He's like, I became like Tom on MySpace. Everyone followed me. Everyone, right? Some of you don't get that, and that's okay. In all my wisdom, he said, in all this, he says, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing that my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. Like, if I thought I wanted it, I just got it, whatever it was. He says, my heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was hevel. It was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Solomon is like, look, in all of this, it may have seemed like I lost my mind, but I knew exactly what I was doing. I kept the end in mind. I didn't lose sight of the goal. I kept my wisdom. And so he engages in this experiment to see if pleasure and pursuing pleasure, if it's going to provide the true satisfaction that he's after. And it just doesn't. Now, we have to be a little bit careful when we talk about Solomon and people like Solomon, because somewhere along the line in religious circles, it was communicated to so many of us, either directly or indirectly, it was communicated this idea that pleasure is a bad thing. And it can almost seem like, with the way people have talked about God, that God is the ultimate curmudgeon, the ultimate killjoy. We have this view of God just sitting in his white robe on the front porch of heaven, just looking down and waiting for us to mess up and yelling at us, get off my lawn, you long-haired hippies, right? Like we have this skewed view of God. And so many of us, we have this view that God does not want us to experience pleasure. That's really a distortion of the truth. You see, God is actually the author of pleasure. God is the one who came up with this idea of things that would bring us pleasure and enjoyment. And I would say that all the things Solomon engages in and then overindulges in, every single one of those are good gifts from God if they are stewarded in the right way and kept within the boundaries that God has established. You see, God is not the enemy of pleasure. I love what C.S. Lewis writes in his very imaginative book called The Screwtape Letters. In this book, Lewis imagines what it would look like if a senior demon were writing down some advice, writing letters to a protege, like a junior demon, about how to lead people astray. And in these letters, this demon will refer to God as the enemy. But here's some advice that the senior demon gives to this junior demon about pleasure. He says, "Never forget that when we're dealing with any pleasure in its healthy and normal and satisfying form, we are, in a sense, on the enemy's ground." Again, this demon is talking about God. He says, I know we have won many a soul through pleasure. All the same, it is his, God's invention, not ours. He made the pleasures. All our research so far has not enabled us to produce one. All we can do is to encourage the humans to take the pleasures which our enemy has produced, God has produced, at times or in ways or in degrees which he has forbidden. And I think there's a lot of truth there. We have been created to enjoy the pleasures that God has given us within the context or the boundaries that he has set. Again, God is the author of pleasure. I mean, think about it. If food was only created to give us energy, then why did God create all of the ingredients that go into ice cream and donuts? Riddle me that, right? God created it for our pleasure, for our enjoyment, as well as for functional reasons. If God created sex only for procreation, well, that building we're building over here would just be for our nursery, right? Like, there'd be a lot of babies. And some of you might be thinking I'm blasphemous, but I'm not. See, God gave us the gift of sex, not just for intimacy or procreation, but also for our pleasure. Again, within the right boundaries, which if you don't know what those boundaries are, let me just be really blunt and clear with you this morning. According to God, sex is to be shared and enjoyed only between one biological man and one biological woman who are married to one another. What Satan does, though, is Satan perverts all the ways that we try to experience God's pleasures. But pleasure in and of itself is not the problem. So if that's the case, then what do we do with Solomon, who pursues pleasure with all of his might, and then he comes back and says, well you can pursue it if you want. But it's just hevel. It's just meaningless. It's like chasing the wind. And I think his words are really a vivid reminder of how deep our void goes. Again, I love what C.S. Lewis talks about in a message called The Weight of Glory. He asserts that God doesn't look at us and say, I can't believe they're seeking their own pleasure. But instead, he looks at us and says, they're not seeking hard enough. Lewis says this. He says, we are half-hearted creatures fooling around with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because we cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at sea, we are far too easily pleased. Now, living on this side of the cross, we have the perspective that Jesus gives us that Solomon did not have. And we read in Romans chapter 1 that when sin entered into this world and fractured it, that Romans 1:23 tells us that you and I, we began to exchange the infinite creator for his creation. And when that took place, we began to settle for temporary fleeting pleasures rather than for what is eternal and soul satisfying. I mean, think about it. Many of you, you've come up with plans for your life. You've had a 5-year, 10-year, 20-year plan. Let's say 10 years ago, you had a picture of what you wanted your life to look like at the beginning of 2025. And you thought, if you could just achieve that, then you'd be happy and you'd be satisfied. And so for the last 10 years, you've put your energy, whether consciously or subconsciously, into getting there. You thought, if I could just finish school, get that dream job, find the right person, maybe have some kids, if I could make enough money for that vacation and get that car I've always been wanting, if I could do this, if I could get that. But the reality is, even if you've met those goals or exceeded them, you're not really done, because you've already replaced that 10-year plan with another 10-year plan. Almost all of us, whether we'll admit it or not, we've bought into this philosophy that what we need to finally make us happy is more and more of what we already possess. But Solomon says, it's just all meaningless. All this stuff and pursuits. And there are many of you, you're hearing this message from Solomon. You're hearing this message this morning. And to be honest, you don't buy what Solomon is saying. You don't believe it. And here's the thing. Because we don't have all those resources at our disposal to get on even the road that Solomon is on, because we don't have all that money and all that time and all that power and all those people to do everything for us, if we're not careful after that thing and never Solomon is trying to teach us, that if you did have all that time, if you did have all that money, if you did have all of that at your disposal, he's trying to tell us you're just going to find yourself right back, as we talked about last week, right back on the treadmill of life. Running and running and running and staying in the same place. So I want to jump ahead to something Solomon said in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and we're going to get into this more in a couple weeks. Tucked in the middle of Ecclesiastes 3:11, Solomon says something very profound. He says that God has set eternity in the human heart. Meaning this, that there's something inside each of us where we were created to long for satisfaction only in the eternal. Like in the deepest parts of our soul remembers what life was like before the fall. Blaise Pascal put it this way. He said that there is a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every man which cannot be filled by any created thing, but only by God, the Creator, made known through Jesus. There is this God-shaped hole in our hearts that we are looking to fill. And we've been reading about some of the ways that Solomon tried to fill that hole. And some of you, you're here today. Because like Solomon, you've been searching for meaning, and everything that you have tried has just left you empty still. And I'm here to tell you that God has set eternity in the human heart. And that searching that you're doing, that hole can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus. I really love the story in John chapter 4. A long story short, Jesus goes and he sits down at a well, and there's this woman with a very sketchy lifestyle that shows up in the middle of the day, the hottest part of the day, to get water from this well, because if she went in the cool of the morning, like the other women did, she would have been shamed. She is a complete social outcast. And Jesus says to her, "Hey, will you give me a drink of that water?" Which was incredibly taboo for Jesus to talk to a woman in public, let alone a Samaritan woman, and one with such a suspect character. She scoops up some water for him and hands it to him, and he takes a drink, and then he starts talking about water. And to paraphrase, Jesus says, "You know, I'm gonna drink this, but I'm gonna get thirsty again." And so she's like, "Well, do you want another cup?" But he continues talking about water, and he says, "You know, people are going to come to this well all day long. In fact, the same women that were here this morning, they're going to return again because they're going to be thirsty again." And he says to her, "Listen, if you drink the water that I'm offering, though, you will never thirst again." And she completely misses it. She says, "You don't even have a cup. So what are you talking about, that you have water?" But what is Jesus saying? He's saying I am eternal. And I fill that void, that vacuum, that longing you have in your heart. In the end, there is nothing under the sun that will bring us lasting fulfillment. You have to look beyond the sun. The hole in our hearts cannot be filled with the temporal. It demands eternity. Therefore, our very searching for more and more and for bigger and better is really our heart telling us that something is off, something is amiss. In the same way that death, pain, and suffering tells us that something is broken in the world, our insatiable searching tells us that something bigger than this earth itself is missing from our soul. And it is pointing us to Jesus. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you for this experiment that we're getting to read from, and I pray that we would garner some wisdom from this. Because like we talked about, most of us are never going to have the money and the resources and the position in life to pursue what Solomon is pursuing. And so if we're not careful, we're just going to continue that search, trying to get more and more and more and more. But Solomon had it all. And he came to this conclusion that it is all meaningless, a chasing after the wind, that there is something more than what is offered by this earth and the things of this earth. And living again on this side of the cross, we know what that thing is. That you have set eternity in our hearts. And we are longing for eternity to come to us. And he has. Jesus has come. And he is the only one who fills that void. He is the only one who provides purpose and meaning and fulfillment and satisfaction. So God, may we not long for the things of this world. May we long for more and more of you. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen. So before we sing this next song, I just want to remind you that during this song, if you have a decision to make about Jesus, or if you just need someone to pray with you, we're going to have some people in our fireside room to your right that would love to talk with you. So anytime during the song, you can head on over there.